know, people talk about the Cold War being over. Well, guess what? There's a new one. There is a new Cold War right now. We're already in it. And as Lightfall puts it, it would be naive to think otherwise.
Well, if there are any future historians left, because this could easily lead to nuclear war.
On this edition of Tell Somebody, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern talks about how the U.S. started a new Cold War with Russia over Ukraine. This is Tom Clamer. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to the podcast of Tell Somebody for July 10, 2014. This show is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the show broadcast weekly on 90.1 FM KKFI Community Radio in Kansas City, Missouri. More information at www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now, or look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. This is your host, Tom Clamer. If you have any comments or questions about the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's show with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley has been posted. Look for links at tellsomebody.us. On with the show. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern returns today for the first of a series of shows, this one about the troubles in Ukraine. Are we in a new Cold War with Russia? If so, how and why did it start? Ray McGovern is a former Army intelligence officer who served 27 years as a CIA analyst. His duties included preparing the president's daily intelligence brief. Ray is a founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and works with Tell the Word, an expression of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, D.C. I recorded this conversation with Ray McGovern on July 3, 2014. Give a listen. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, John.
Been looking on your website, www.raymcgovern.com, and I get alerts from Consortium News. And it seems like a great deal of your attention lately is still focused on Ukraine. Tell me why that's so important right now.
Well, you know, people talk about the Cold War being over. Well, guess what? There's a new one. I didn't really quite appreciate how acute the danger is until I listened to professors that I really respect. First and foremost, Stephen Cohen of NYU and Bob Lightfall, who used to head up the Russian Institute at Columbia. They're very, very strong on the fact that it is a new Cold War right now. We're already in it. And as Lightfall puts it, it would be naive to think otherwise. The focus, of course, is on Ukraine right now, and maybe Tom would be good to give you a little sit-rep, situation report on recent doings, because they've been quite interesting. Would that be okay?
Yes, please. Let's hear it.
Well, the big news, of course, came on Tuesday morning when the world learned that Poroshenko, the new Ukrainian president, had decided to attack You can watch his declaration there on TV. He's very strong. He uses the Ukrainian word, which is the same as Russian, for attack. It's naступat, okay? Naступat is really stronger than napadat, because napadat just means to attack. Naступат is Stalingrad, okay? That's rejecting and giving a resolute defeat to the invader. For your younger listeners, Stalingrad was the battle that turned the tide in World War II. It lasted from August 42 to February 43. It was then that the Nazis were really defeated. It took a while to chase them back into Germany. But by the time we came in, the 6th of June, it was pretty much a done deal. And that's why the Russians in particular resent the notion that we celebrate Normandy, when really they stemmed the tide not only in Stalingrad but at Kursk, where there was an incredibly large tank battle where the Germans were turned back. So when they hear U.S. politicians saying, for example, that Russian representatives should not have been allowed to attend Normandy celebrations, well, it just makes them bristle.
I can imagine. Not taking away anything from American sacrifices on D-Day, but John Wayne and Hershey Bar, we didn't win the war all by ourselves?
Well, that's the impression that the Russians have of how we look at it, and that really bristles. For your younger listeners, the estimates of how many Russians were killed in World War II range from about 22 to 29 million. Now, that's not to downplay all the Germans and the French and British and our own soldiers, but that's the fact. So the Russians are coming out of this world view where Germany was really not a friendly country. They had to fear it. And really, in a way, that impinges on how they look at Ukraine. Yeah, this is probably worth going into a little background, Tom.
Yeah, please.
Since we started about World War II, after World War II, the U.S. emerged as the sole remaining superpower in the world. Okay, that was 1945, partly because the Soviet Union had been pretty much destroyed, Germany too, France largely, even Britain was on its back. So it wasn't when the Soviet Union fell, it was then, right after the war. And we did everything we could, of course, to remain the sole remaining superpower in the world. And when the Soviet Union was our rival, we were certainly kind of hemmed in, at least we were restrained. They had nuclear weapons, we did, and there was a deterrence. Usually Americans look at deterrence in terms of we deterring the Russians. Well, it worked the other way, too. The Russian deterrent capability deterred us. And I dare say, if the Soviet Union was still in existence in 2003, George Bush and Dick Cheney would have had to think very, very long and hard about mounting a war of aggression in Iraq. So that's sort of a little background there. And what I'd like to do is come forward to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Many will remember those incredible photos of the Berlin Wall being chopped up by jubilant East Germans and West Germans. And that happened in November of 1979. And it looked like...
1989?
I'm sorry, 1989, right? Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
1989, and it looked very much like, all hell is going to break loose in Eastern Europe. Why? People don't realize this, but the Soviets had 24 highly mechanized divisions in East Germany. 24. Now that correlates to maybe 240,000 soldiers, all right? And the historical precedent, of course, was if things got out of hand in Budapest, as they did in 1956, or in Prague, as they did in 1968, in came the Soviet tanks, right? Well, we were all very concerned about what kinds of pressures Gorbachev, who was then the party leader in Moscow, and his foreign minister, Shevardnadze, what kind of pressures they would be under from their own military and security forces, and people who, you know, really feared the resurgence of Germany in particular, would they use 24 divisions again? And so what happened was a pretty good result here at first, because George H.W. Bush, to his credit, called Gorbachev, and he said, look, you know, we're sorry for your troubles there in East Berlin, but look, I'm not going to dance on the Berlin Wall. He said, look, this is pretty volatile. Let's get together. I'd like to do it sooner rather than later. Let's get it together before Christmas. The Berlin Wall fell second week of November, if memory serves, and it was indeed 1989. Let's get together in Malta. And so they did, first week of December 1989. And Bush said, look, let's do a deal here. We're not going to take advantage of your troubles in Eastern Europe. It looks like you're going to lose the rest of the East European satellites as well. But we want to make sure that you don't use those 24 divisions in East Germany. And Gorbachev said, well, yeah, let's make sense. Let's talk about that, and let's come to an agreement. But I have to talk with my generals and with my security people and everybody else. So why don't you send Jim Baker, your Secretary of State, over to Moscow, and why don't we say early February, and let's do a deal. And that's what happened. Baker went over there, talked with Gorbachev, talked with Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, and Jack Matlock, who was our ambassador there, was, of course, in on all those discussions, as he was in on the discussions 2 months previous in Malta. The deal was struck. What Baker said was, look, we know that you've said enough times that you don't want to reunify Germany. And we can understand that. And just parenthetically, Tom, I can tell you that I didn't want to reunify Germany either. I lived in Germany for 5 years. There are some Germans that are really good friends of mine, but I didn't want to reunify that was just a sort of instinctive reflection, reaction, and that's partly because I was old enough to have lived through World War II. So, long story short, Baker said, here's the deal. We want a reunified Germany. We know that that's a hard pill for you to swallow, Gorbachev, but we'll keep it in NATO, okay? And therefore, there'll be no danger that a reunified Germany will develop the nuclear weapon, for example. We'll keep it constrained. And in return for your acquiescence in that, and in return for your bringing those 42 divisions back into the Soviet Union, we will promise, and I promise herewith, not to move NATO 1 inch further eastward. I guess the right word is farther. The promise was, not 1 inch farther eastward would NATO go. Okay, that's February 1990, okay? So, that was pretty much it here, too. Germany became reunified. The Soviet troops went back to the Soviet Union. And along about 1996, when Bill Clinton's in a tough, what he thought was a tough electoral challenge from Bob Dole says, you know, I've been talking to the Hungarians and the Poles and the Czech Republic, and they'd like to join NATO to protect themselves from the Russian menace. Now, you know, the Russian menace had long since kind of imploded, right? But Dole was tough on defense, and so Bill Clinton asked his advisors, well, what are we going to do about that? It's only 3 weeks away from the election, and I've got to look strong on defense. And maybe I ought to say the same thing. You know, we'll bring Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic into NATO, and I'll do it a year before. Bob Dole will do it. How about that? And his advisors had to tell him, well, actually, Bill, we promised the Russians that we wouldn't do that. You promised? What do you mean you promised? Well, and they told the story about February 1990, the promise undertaken in return for the peaceful reunification of Germany, withdrawal of Soviet troops, blah, blah, blah. And Clinton said, okay, let me see the paper on that. And, you know, the devil's in the details. Guess what? No one set this thing down on paper. Now, they could have simply asked Ambassador Matlock, who was there, They could have asked Jim Baker, but no, it was 3 weeks before the election. Clinton just announced that he would embrace Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic into NATO, and he'd do it faster than Bob Dole. That started the avalanche. Long story short, a couple of years later, there were 12, count them, 12 new members of NATO, all far more than inches farther away from Germany, toward the east, toward Russia. And, the original number of NATO countries was 12, so they've doubled in size now. And then if you fast forward to 2008, at one of these summit meetings with the top political and military leaders of the NATO countries, they met in Bucharest, and the final declaration decided, not in the subjunctive, but in the indicative case, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, end quote, period. So, that threw down the gauntlet for the Russians. We know what happened next. Saakashvili, that intemperate leader of Georgia, decided, well, that gave him carte blanche. The neocons would protect him, and he started artillery rounds against a Russian-friendly minority on the other side of Georgia. And he got a really, really bloody nose. He got a really bloody nose right quick. There was nothing that the Bush regime or anybody else could do about it. Now, with Ukraine, sort of just stewed along because of various changes in leadership, but that's still on the books, Tom, and that's the important thing. NATO still would like to draw Ukraine away from the Russian sphere of influence into NATO, first step being into the European Union, and away from Russia. Well, what does it mean for Russia? Well, if you look at Russian history, they suffered for centuries for the lack of a warm seaport. And Catherine the Great, who was in power about the same time as our revolution here in the United States, she extended Moscow's rule down to and including Ukraine and Crimea. And they set up this incredibly large naval port called in Sevastopol. And they've been plying the seas from that port ever since the late 18th century. Now, that's where the headquarters of the Soviet Navy that can get out during the winter operates from, gets out to the Mediterranean and to other places. Now, the prospect of Sevastopol in the Crimea being taken over by NATO was just, too much for the Russians on its face. But more so, since not only are the Russians really upset about the advancement of NATO to Russian borders, but they're also afraid of this missile defense system. Now, what's that? Well, it's something that George Bush ginned up. As you know, the anti-ballistic missile programs have been the biggest corporate welfare programs in the United States history. The systems will never work, and you can quote me on that, because I've talked to all manner of engineers and scientists. They can always be defeated, but there are billions and billions and billions of dollars in it, and so they keep trying. Ones that they've built don't work. You can see by their trials. Anyhow, the builders of these missiles and missile defense systems make a lot of money out of these things, and they persuaded the powers that be in the Bush administration that we ought to have a ballistic missile defense system against, well, it should be in Europe, and I'll see who could be against. Let's say it's against Iran, and anybody who knew anything about Iran would say, well, Iran doesn't have any ballistic missiles we're speaking about, and besides, they're not working on a nuclear weapon like everybody thinks. And so, yeah, but let's just say it's against Iran, and we'll put it in there, and we'll steal the march on the Russians, because by and by, it'll become capable of a first strike, not only on their medium range, but on their ICBMs, their intercontinental ballistic missiles, and so we'll have the equivalent of a first strike capability. Won't that be dandy? Well, the Russians know full well that our tests of these missiles have failed, but if I were a Russian planner, I would think, well, you know, I can't rely on them continuing to fail, and even worse, I can't rely on people who think that they might work and might try something against our ICBM force. And so the Russians feel very strongly about this kind of thing. And so with the help of the Russians, there were a lot of Poles and a lot of Czechs who objected to the emplacement of these missile systems, anti-ballistic missile systems, in their countries. And so Bobby Gates got a great idea. He was the defense secretary under Bush and then later under Obama. He said, let's put them on ships. Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, we could do that. We'll put these ballistic, anti-ballistic missiles things on ships, and we'll sail them in the Black Sea. And, man, that would be great, you know. We'll be even closer to the Russians. And when Gates was asked about this, about how the Russians might react, he said, well, you know, I don't stay up night worrying about how the Russians react, you know. I just worry about how strong we can be. Well, hello, that's hubris. So, yeah. Long story short, where are these ships that have anti-ballistic missile systems on them going to be placed? Well, they can be put in the Black Sea. The Treaty of Montreux gives people the entree to the Black Sea through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, and they can be right close to those Soviet ICBM things that until now have been a deterrent. So this is something that bothers Putin and the rest of them, and don't take my word for it. Putin himself has said that NATO encroachment eastward is bad enough, but what really worries me, what really I can't understand, is A, why the U.S. considers it necessary to develop this anti-ballistic missile system, B, why it thinks it can put it in the Black Sea, and C, why it doesn't think we'll react to that kind of thing, you know? And D, why they won't talk to us about it. And every time Putin raises this thing, he finishes up by saying, you know, we just want to talk about this with Washington. And they always say, quote, it's none of your business. It's none of your business, end quote.
Yeah, oh. Ray, I'm just thinking as you're talking about this, you know, it's a completely different situation because Russia is evil and we are inherently lily white and pure good. But how would United States leaders and military and citizens feel about Russian anti-ballistic missile ships cruising the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico or something like that?
Well, you know, we have some precedent for that when the Russians tried to put missiles in Cuba in 1962. I was around then, and I know how we reacted because, I don't know if I've shared with you this, but my called active duty as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Infantry, Army, was on the 3rd of November, 1962. And when I showed up at Army Officer Infantry School that day, there were no weapons for us to train with. There was a fancy thing called a grenade launcher. New technology, okay? But there weren't any at Fort Benning. They were all in Key West. You know, they're all ready to go into Cuba.
Right.
We're talking early November 1962. That's how close we were. All grenade launchers from Fort Benning were already at Key West. So,
and
you know
had people like General LeMay wanting to drop nuclear bombs and start World
yeah.
War III, right?
Yeah, thank God for John Kennedy who resisted all that stuff. So, you know, there isn't any John Kennedy around anymore. And, you know, when you have the John Kerrys around and the Victoria Nulands, you've got real problems because there's no restraint. Matter of fact, they're egging Obama on. So with respect to the Ukraine, let me just kind of wrap this up here because I've gone into maybe a little bit too much history, but that's the background here when all of a sudden we have the National Endowment for Democracy, which in many ways people acknowledge is sort of the successor to what we used to call the covert action arm of the CIA, getting all manner of money. Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, says that the United States has invested $5 billion in Now that's B with a B as in boy, okay? $5 billion for what? Well, to encourage Ukraine's aspirations for close identification with Europe. Well, hello. What does that mean? Well, that means at least 65 projects which have been identified, funded by the National Endowment for Democracy in Ukraine, and it means that they were already, including the training of fascists, and I use the word advisedly, in places like Poland and elsewhere, who should know better, training of fascists of the right sector, Svoboda, two parties in Ukraine, so that they already caused lots of trouble on the streets of Kiev when the sound was sounded. Now, that happened in November of last year. Putin was in Sochi at the Olympics, and everything seemed to be going pretty well. But he had made a really bad, bad move by stopping a war. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the neoconservatives, and I probably should define that term, in my view, they are people who have great difficulty distinguishing between the strategic aims and interests of Israel on the one hand and the United States on the other. Now, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but I don't think those people should be running the foreign policy of the United States, and they have been, and they are on Ukraine as well. So what they want to say, he stopped the war, that is, Putin stopped the war, the neoconservatives were just on the, well, they were inches away from getting Obama to authorize a strike on Syria, which would widen the war, which had been bedlam. And John Kerry lied 35 times at the State Department on August 30 when he said, we know that it was Bashar al-Assad who authorized the employment of chemical weapons against the outskirts of Damascus. Well, he didn't know. He was lying through his teeth. It was the rebels. We pretty much knew that Kerry was lying because he didn't know. We didn't know either. But we had sources within the intelligence community that told us, look, we're not going to do Iraq again. We're not going to lie. It's not clear, but it looks very much like it was the rebels that fired those chemical weapons. So what I'm saying here is that the president was all set to go. And what happened? How was he bailed out? He was bailed out by Vladimir Putin, who said, look, Mr. President, we can do a deal here. We can get the Syrians to give up their chemical weapons. How would that be? And Obama said, oh, yeah, are you sure? And he said, yeah, we can. Now, tell Kerry to knock it off, will you? So Obama tells Kerry to knock it off. Instead, he sends Kerry to Geneva, and within one week, the agreement is reached to get rid of all the Syria's chemical weapons. The war is avoided. Why does Israel want a war in Syria? Well, because as long as you keep the Sunni and Shia at each other's throats, killing each other, they're not going to turn their weaponry or their attention to Israel. And I'm not talking just about Syria. I'm talking about the whole region. As you can see now, Israel may feel more secure for the nonce because Sunni and Shia are each other's throats. So that was the general idea. Kerry is a neocon, and so is Victoria Nuland. She's the, I call her, the neocon prima donna, being married to one of the authors of all this. Anyhow, so here's how Victoria Nuland and John McCain and Kerry, they all look at Putin and say, darn, Putin, you rascal, you. You stopped us from our war. So this is background. They hate Putin. They hated him from Syria. And as soon as Sochi was over, he had to confront this bedlam in the streets of Kiev, where we know Nuland herself was passing out cookies. She's captured on the phone talking to the U.S. ambassador there, the one from Kiev. They're talking about who should be the next prime minister. And she says, Yats is our guy. The other people can wait in the wings, but Yats is good because he ran the central bank in Ukraine, and he knows the kinds of austerity measures have to be introduced because the EU and blah, 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 blah. So Yats is our guy. Now, 4 weeks later, I wake up turn in the news, and guess what?
I wrote Yahtzee's our guy.
The title says was, yikes, it's Yahtzee.
Yeah.
So you would have think, you would have thought that with this telephone conversation between Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, that, you know, it being on record 4 weeks before the putsch, that, you know, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind would have sort of disqualified Yahtzee from being the interim prime minister. But no, it's put right in there. So the putsch was mounted with the encouragement and the financing of not only countries in Western Europe, but especially the United States. And that brings us up to the current situation where the coup was made. People out in the eastern part of Ukraine didn't like the fact that their duly elected president, Yanukovych, was removed from office, and very much careful what was likely in store for them at the hands of these new folks, mostly from the western Ukraine, and the fascists that spearheaded the coup.
Let me just jump in here a second. We've been talking to Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, about goings on in Ukraine. And we have to stop here for a message, but we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer, and we're talking to former CIA analyst Ray McGovern about Ukraine. And Ray, before the break, you were talking about how Victoria Nuland caught on a telephone recording basically picking the new head of Ukraine. Yikes, it's Yahtzee, you titled a piece. Pick it up where we left it off there.
Yeah, Yatsenyuk is his full name. I guess she didn't really take the trouble to learn the full name. It's enough to identify who your puppet's going to be. And he's the one that's been talking now about the, quote, subhumans, end quote, in the eastern part of Ukraine.
Wow.
You know, when you start using labels like that, the flags go up, at least for me. Subhumans, vermin, scum, parasites. Now, those were all used when I was really, really young by folks in the Nazi regime. People want to exterminate others and like to call them bugs.
Exactly.
So here's the Prime Minister of Ukraine calling people in the East who objected to the putsch, the coup d'etat. He's calling them subhuman. Where do you remember subhuman being used before? Well, that's rhetorical, of course. What happened was that the United States immediately recognized this unconstitutional coup. And it was not only unconstitutional, but it was incredibly, what's the word? Well, immoral sounds kind of trite. It was the day after an agreement had been reached between the Polish, the French, and the German foreign ministers, a representative of Putin in Russia, and the Ukrainians. The agreement was Yanukovych would leave. There'd be elections at the end of the year. There's no way he would be reelected president, and the crowds would be tamped down. Okay, now that was February 21. So what happens the next day? Instead of the violence on Maidan, the square there being tamped down, the right sector and Svoboda, these two fascist parties, they're grouped in sort of military formations of 100 each, and they lead the putsch. They have snipers on top of the buildings, and the Western press, if you read it, so well, these snipers were Yanukovych's people, and, they stirred up the violence. Well, we know from another intercepted conversation that the foreign minister of Estonia learned and told the foreign policy guru of the EU, the European Union, he told her in an intercepted conversation that his information was that it was the same snipers that were shooting not only the police, but shooting the protesters. So that it would look like, not only that it would stir up things so that not only the the protesters would be shot by the police, but the police themselves. And so what happened on the next day was the coup. Now, Yanukovych, to his, he got out of Dodge right quick. And Putin, interestingly enough, in his speech says, Yanukovych told me what he's going to do. I told him, that's crazy. Don't do that, You can agree to leave office, but don't withdraw your security forces. That will just lead to bedlam. And Putin says, well, he didn't listen to me, and now look what's happened. Well, what's happened is this. The people in the east, that is in Donetsk and Slovyansk and other major cities, and these are fairly sizable cities in the region called the Donbass, because it's the basin of the Don River, they rose up and they've taken control of some of those cities. And the question was, well, how do you resolve this? Now, there was a very easy way to resolve it if people were willing, and that would be to give them some regional autonomy, have new elections, and give them some guarantee about their security, a guarantee that they could use Russian as an official language, and work out a system for the whole country whereby it could live in peace, not as a pawn between Russia and NATO, but would forswear membership in NATO, like Finland. Now, Finland is also hard by Russia, lost a lot of territory to Russia in various wars, but is intact now and is free and very, very prosperous precisely because the Russians do not fear the Finns. The Finns have disavowed any intent to join any military alliance. Now, that could work with the Ukrainians. But no, they didn't want to do that. And why did they want to do that? Because they're U.S. puppets. And Nuland and Kerry and the others were saying, don't do it. Now, we ought to fast forward here to what's happened just over the last week. There was an abortive ceasefire that was supposed to be introduced about 10 days ago. Both sides apparently violated it, but it was still a more peaceable situation than had been the case theretofore. And what happens next is that the NATO folks that want peace there, the Europeans, namely the French and the Germans, are interested in not letting the situation fall into a state of complete disrepair. They want a renewal of this ceasefire. So, what do? They spend all weekend talking with Poroshenko, the new president of the Ukraine, and Lavrov, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, and it's Fabius from France and Steinmüller from Germany, and they're trying to persuade Poroshenko to renew the ceasefire. Well, he gets up on Tuesday morning before my time, and he says, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to attack. We're going to attack and free our lands, okay? And he sends his troops, including aircraft and tanks and artillery, eastward into the eastern part of Ukraine, and the battle is rejoined. Now, the next step was really interesting because Steinmeier, the German foreign minister, said this is this is crazy. So he invites Fabius from France and Lavrov from Russia, and the Ukrainian foreign minister Pavlo Klimkin to Berlin. Talk about this. Let's see if we can do something about this because this is crazy. The only country that justified, in quotes, the renewed attack by Poroshenko and his forces was, guess what?
Us.
United States.
Yeah.
Who said, we can, everybody has the right to defend themselves, right? Okay. So what happens? They meet and they issue a statement which says there should be a sustainable ceasefire. Now, again, this is all four foreign ministers, Russia, France, Germany, and Ukraine. So in some ways, this doesn't really parse. Why is the Ukrainian foreign minister joining in all this when Poroshenko has already sent the troops to the front to violate the ceasefire? Anyhow, I haven't figured it out yet, but anyhow, the four of them said there should be an unconditional ceasefire okay? Unconditional. That means nobody's going to require anything of the others. Like Kiev has always said, well, people in the East need to disarm and all that stuff before we talk to them. So this plan is now up for grabs. It's been focused on. The idea, the important thing is that Kiev now officially has accepted that a ceasefire will not be contingent upon the disarmament of the forces in the East. And so the question will be, well, will Kerry call Poroshenko and tell him, maybe you ought to knock it off now? Kerry, by the way, was not invited to Berlin with the rest of them. Neither was Haig from Britain. Haig in Britain they consider just a little puppet of the United States. And this move by the Europeans, France and Germany, together with Lavrov from Russia and the Ukrainian foreign minister, this is really meaningful because, for once, the French and the Germans froze the United States out and didn't act as kind of a knee-jerk, a sycophant to Washington. So this gives me some hope to think that we'll be able to work ourselves out of this, the more so because, well, let's put it this way, the Ukrainian forces have not distinguished themselves in battle. A lot of those people are cousins of the people in the East. They don't want to be killing their cousins. And even though many of the fascists of Svoboda and the right sector are leading these units now and acting as the, quote, National Guard, end quote, there's real doubt as to whether they can prevail in the eastern part of the Ukraine, and particularly, you know, in the cities. Are they prepared to go in fight block by block? I don't think so. So I think if Victoria Nuland and John Kerry think that they can mousetrap Putin into sending his tanks into Ukraine, I think that he's smart enough to involve that, to avoid that. And worst comes to worst, if there starts to be a kind of a genocide in the eastern Ukraine, well, you know, we have the U.S. has a favorite little gimmick. We call it the no-fly zone. It would be more difficult in Ukraine, but certainly Putin could tell his Air Force to wreak havoc with any Ukrainian aircraft that were fighting in the eastern Ukraine. So there are things that Putin can do short of sending in the tanks. I think he's intent on avoiding being mousetrapped like that. But the last thing I'll say on this is that he's got his own John McCain's to deal with, okay? He's got his own hardliners, including, I was just listening to him, Glasiev, his economic advisor, who's talking about the eventual objective of the U.S. is to snatch Sevastopol in Crimea back for NATO. Now, if they really think that that's the ultimate objective, if they really are afraid that even though they exert full control over Crimea, that if Ukraine goes west, there'll be a real threat, well, Putin's got to act on that. And this is a matter of national security for Russia. It is not a matter of national security for the United States. And if Russia has to give the United States a bloody nose here, the NATO a bloody nose, well, he will, and the only people will profit from it are the arms manufacturers, the arms merchants, who will be able to sell lots more armament to the countries of Europe, who will then feel threatened by a resurgent Russia. So it's kind of complicated, but people should know that what's going on here is supported by the fascists who actually spearheaded the revolution on the streets of Kiev on 22 February. And if they want to read a really good article on that, have them check out Stephen Cohen's article in the current issue of The Nation. Stephen Cohen is one of the professors from whom I've learned an awful lot about Russia and about the Eastern Europe. And he's golden on this. He's done this research, and he paints a very, very dangerous picture of who's leading and you know, who is spearheading these things. And not only that, but there is a real question as to whether Poroshenko is able. You know, even if you wanted to restrain these guys, whether he's able to influence or to direct or order the right sector and the Svoboda parties to stop their advance there in the eastern Ukraine. And there have been some real massacres already, as most people know, particularly in Odessa a month or so ago, where lots of people were killed. So it's a pretty volatile situation. I hope that Obama will open his ears to those of us who know a little bit about Russia and a little bit about Ukraine, and who will give him a straight scoop about the dangers here. Because, you know, John Kerry, I mean, somebody asked him 2 months ago, are you not aware, do you not take into account the fact that you're flirting with danger with another nuclear-armed country that could destroy us? And he looked at the president, oh, yeah, sure, I take that into account. Yeah, I'm quite aware of that. Yes, I know that's a possibility. Well, if I were a Russian and I saw that kind of off-the-hand, flippant, nonchalant response, it would worry me greatly. And maybe I'll just close by saying, if you want evidence that there's a new Cold War, well, there it is. And it's largely due to the fact that we in the West have tried to advance NATO against a threat that really did not exist. And lastly, and this is the sad part, I talked about 25 years ago when the Berlin Wall fell. George H.W. Bush had already spoken about a Europe that was whole and free, okay, a Europe from Portugal to the Urals. And what's happened? Well, people decided to exclude Russia from that Europe. Russia was ready to be joined by Western Europe. It's always been Russia's historic future that they aspired to, and yet they were rejected, and now we have a situation which is very explosive, being stoked by people who want to take over Ukraine, its fertile land, and its what's left of its industry, and bring it into the corporate control of the West. So,
yeah.
Volatile, we need to watch it.
You mentioned Professor Stephen Cohen in his piece on The Nation magazine. I saw him online on an appearance on the Tom Hartman show, and I wish I had the exact quote, but he said something to the effect that for the U.S.'s own national interests, the most...
And this is where my patriotic passion comes into play. I am convinced that the most essential partner for American national security in all of these areas, from Iran to Syria to Afghanistan and beyond, is the Kremlin, currently occupied by Putin. And the way the United States has treated Putin, I would call it a betrayal of American national interest.
And the Ukraine situation doesn't seem to be quite as prominent in the press as it was a few weeks ago, but the impression is of this naked aggression by Putin, the impression I get from the corporate media. You know, he is the aggressor in Ukraine, but when I listen to what you've said and get some specifics, he pulled our chestnuts out of the fire in Syria, much to the disappointment of rabid warmongers like McCain and others. He aided diplomacy with Iran. He is talking about diplomatic efforts rather than continued carnage in Ukraine, and it seems like this is all the aggressiveness stoking this up is the United States, and some of it started with pressuring Ukraine to take an IMF loan, which I liken the IMF to mafia loan sharks. The conditions that go along with these so-called loans are privatization of the commons and austerity that has caused all kinds of unrest in Greece and does no good and has been pretty thoroughly discredited, except in the corporate media. What's going on?
Well, that clearly was... was the plan to get the Ukraine into the EU regime, and they offered the previous Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, this deal, which they said it was a really sweet deal, you know, we can get you in there and then we'll get you in NATO as well. Well, when he read the fine print and he saw the austerity measures that would be necessary under the IMF guidelines, you know, he said, my goodness, are we really going to do this? And so at that time, he's talking to the Russians as well, and they too were pressuring him not to do this, of course. And they said, look, we'll give you a far better deal. We'll bail you out with billions and billions of dollars. We'll continue to give you natural gas at cut big prices. So this is a much better deal for you. So whereas in early November of last year, Yanukovych seemed to be bending toward accepting the EU blandishments, he thought better of it, rejected it, and accepted the deal from Moscow. And that was seized upon by the people that Victoria Nuland and John Kerry befriended, and John McCain. John McCain appeared on the dais with known right sector fascists, okay? In the back, you know, this is interesting, you see emblems that not only resemble very closely swastikas, okay, but guess what? A Confederate flag.
Oh, boy.
A U.S. Confederate flag. I mean, that's how racist these guys are. So it was not too difficult for Yanukovych to say, well, all right, I'll stay within the Russian economic orbit here, partly because the industry in eastern Ukraine and the Donbass area, I mean, they have no buyers except the former Soviet Union, now Russia, because their tools are made to make weaponry and machinery that Russia uses. So they have to close up. Those factories are antiquated as well. So the Ukraine would become even more of a basket case. The likes of Monsanto will be in there for their very fertile black earth to exploit that. And, you know, the Ukraine would have become sort of like a basket case like Greece, like you just mentioned, where there'd be a supply of cheap labor because the Ukrainians have nowhere else to make a buck. And then from Moscow's point of view, more strategically, they would become beholden to NATO and the EU. And right on Russia's doorstep. Russia would just never tolerate that. And one thing I didn't mention, which is kind of interesting, you know, you learn all kinds of stuff from WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
And it just came to my attention that there was a cable from Moscow, a State Department cable, by the ambassador to Moscow. His name is Bill Burns. Right now he's the Deputy Secretary of State. And he was our ambassador there, and this was, January or February of 2008. Why do I mention that? Well, because the NATO summit that said Ukraine should be a member of NATO happened in early April of 2008. So what's the title of this telegram or cable from Moscow? The title is, Nyet means Nyet.
Okay.
What does it talk about? It talks about Lavrov, who is still the foreign minister, reading the Riot Act to Bill Burns, saying, look, if you think that Ukraine will be allowed to become part of NATO, niet, and niet means niet, don't even think about it. Now, that's two months, 2 short months before they meet in Bucharest, and the final declaration agreed to by all the leaders of these NATO countries is that Ukraine and Georgia will, not subjunctive would or should or might, will become members of NATO. So, you know, it's not as though the United States was not warned that this was a niet. And if you, as you say, if you analyze it, if you put an analogy and think about Mexico or Canada, you know, how would we feel about the Warsaw Pact, if it still existed, embracing Canada or Mexico into its orbit?
Ray, I think we're about out of time. Any real quick final thoughts before we let you go?
Well, I just ask that all your listeners be terribly aware of how they're not getting the full story on Ukraine from the what's called the mainstream press. And any time they hear this propaganda about Russian aggression and all that kind of thing, well, they got to think closely about what they might do in terms of responding, and actually even responding to the Congress people, because Congress is just as bad as the mainstream. Did I say the mainstream? Freudian slip. The mainstream media in painting, you know, black hats and white hats. And I'll just finish by saying, you know, if you say that there are white hats, us, and black hats, the Russians, well, black hats are the ones in the Ukraine in between. I don't know what color hat they have on, but I know what the color of their shirt is, and they're brown shirts. And the brown shirts are the real danger here. And I think that's one reason why the Russians are reaching out to the French and to the Germans to say, look, you really want to acquiesce in brown shirts doing what they're doing in the eastern Ukraine? I think not.
Okay, well, we'll leave it for that until next time. Ray McGovern, thank you very much for spending some time
with us today. You're most welcome, Tom.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.